The cause number is 1321-180-CV, Cameron County versus John Paul Saucy.
May it please the court. Cameron County is appealing from the denial of a plea to the jurisdiction, and the county made that plea to the jurisdiction on two grounds. One is that the Tort Claims Act's emergency exception preserved the county's immunity, and the other is that Officer Daniel Galvan's official immunity prevented a waiver of the county's immunity. The emergency exception is in Section 101.055 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and the policy behind that exception, as explained by the Supreme Court in City of Amarillo versus Martin, is that we don't want to deter emergency personnel from acting decisively and taking calculated risks in order to save life or property. From Galvan's perspective, you have Mr. Saucy, who would have him wait in the bumper-to-bumper traffic. But if someone had been injured in a disturbance, an assault, or an accident on the north end of South Padre Island, the victims there would be saying that Saucy made a bad police decision by waiting in the bumper-to-bumper traffic. This kind of catch-22 is why we have the emergency exception. The burden of proof for this exception derives from the principle that the plaintiff has the burden of proof on issues of subject matter jurisdiction, including whether governmental immunity is waived. So as this court said in City of Kingsville versus Dominguez in 2000, the plaintiff bears the burden to establish that the emergency response exception does not apply. The first question—
Mr. Miller?
Yes.
I'd like to ask a question first. When it comes to ascertaining whether it's an emergency and referring back to our analysis in the Torres versus the City of Corpus Christi case, of which I was on panel, it seemed to decide first whether the scenario was an emergency or not. And emergency isn't defined. So in that, we just took what emergency actually means to the layperson. And I think I'm trying to get the case back up on my computer here. And in that case, we found that as a matter of law, that as defined, that it was an emergency situation because that was a stolen car that they were trying to stop. But do we not have here a fact issue as to whether in this circumstances there was an actual emergency? There wasn't anybody that was already injured or somebody that was, like in all the other circumstances, that there it's a high speed chase. And in this circumstances, aren't we faced with a scenario that we really should send it back to ascertain as a fact issue on this jurisdiction?
Well, there's not going to be a fact issue because the evidence is not controverted. It's basically the parties disagree about the legal effect of that evidence. We have to keep in mind that we have a statute that waives immunity. So we're instructed by the Supreme Court in cases such as City of San Antonio versus Hartman and Hillman versus Nueces County that we have to construe these statutes in favor of retaining immunity whenever there's doubt.
But if you were to follow your train of thought, Mr. Miller, then every time a police officer is called for whatever reason, it would be an emergency call. And that's definitely not what's in the statute, because you're saying if you were to say in this circumstances, he received a phone call, was en route to that call, then that's an emergency and end of discussion. And that's not what the statute says.
Well, the statute doesn't define emergency.
Right.
And there's nothing in the statute that requires that a crime or injury must occur before it's an emergency. We do have a little bit of an issue of...
Well, according to our opinion in Torres, Mr. Miller, an emergency is an unexpected and unusually dangerous situation. And this is how we have set our precedent in this court, that calls for immediate action. So when we're looking at Officer Galvan's testimony at this segment under the plea of jurisdiction, does that fit under as we've defined it in this court?
It does, because from the department's perspective, the crowd out there was unexpected. They had a situation where they had more people than one officer could safely handle. But we also have to keep in mind that when you're looking at dictionary definitions, it's not always the most popular definition that comes first. And also, because we have to resolve ambiguities in favor of immunity, what we really should be looking for is the most, is the broadest definition in common use. So defining emergency as an urgent need for help or assistance is appropriate. That goes with the legislature's intent, and to define emergency any narrower contradicts the idea that we have to resolve ambiguities in favor of retaining immunity.
Mr. Miller.
Yes.
If we agree with you on that aspect of the definition, doesn't the fact that the appellee has called into question whether a phone call even took place, since there's absolutely no record of that by the police dispatch or the police officers, doesn't that create a fact question?
Well, it doesn't. Let me start off with, because the plaintiff has a burden of proof, he can't rely on the absence of evidence to establish something. He's got to go forth with the evidence. He had opportunities to conduct discovery. There's nothing in the statute that requires that you document a call in order for it to be an emergency. There's nothing that requires that every emergency situation, because remember, you can have an emergency call or an emergency situation. There's nothing that requires that every emergency situation be documented. Mm-hmm. We have an officer who gave this testimony.
I'm sorry, Mr. Miller, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I want you to include that in this circumstances, it's not only, first of all, that you're trying to prove a negative, which is always hard, no matter what you're trying to do. And second of all, you have an incident report that doesn't in any way at the scene of the accident indicate that the police officer was on a call. There's absence of it being documented.
That is Silva's report. And Silva was concerned about the facts of the crash. He had no reason to mention what was going on in the North End in that report. And just because he didn't say anything doesn't mean that he didn't consider there to be an emergency. If the plaintiffs wanted something from Silva, they could have deposed him and put his testimony into the record, but they did not. We have to construe the statute broadly, and there was nothing that required Galvan to wait for a child to be run over, a drunken fight to break out, or an assault on a colleague to properly treat this as an emergency situation. We want officers to take action to protect us, not wait until something bad has already happened. So we have cases like the Rocha case out of Austin, where there was a knife-wielding man in the Dollar General parking lot, and that was an emergency, even though no one had yet been hurt by that knife-wielding individual. You have cases like the Kenziora case out of Beaumont, where there was a fight at a sports complex, and that was considered an emergency, despite there not being any mention of anybody being injured. You have those opportunities to respond. Hartman was an emergency, even though the city had hours to place barricades out on roads, and for whatever reason, didn't place a barricade out on Rigsby Road, which is the highway to Victoria. So, you have a statute that broadly, emergency should be broadly construed. But this also leads me into.
Let me ask you, Mr. Miller, though. Let's say that we agree with, and let's say we don't agree with you, and we decide that there is a fact issue on the emergency. Does the official immunity then save you, even if we decide there's a fact question on the emergency?
Because, official immunity is out there to do things like protect an officer who believes in good faith that he is responding to an emergency or an urgent need for assistance, and therefore should accept additional risks that he would not ordinarily accept. And so, we have a situation where, the evidence here established good faith. I mentioned the Ross case in that letter yesterday because that's a good example of how good faith is established. There, the officer's testimony showed the potential danger to the person present at an accident scene, and that the potential danger was greater than the risk of an accident if he crossed the freeway almost perpendicular to traffic to get to that scene. When you apply the factors in our case, You have to keep in mind that the standard is whether any reasonably prudent officer could have believed that the conduct was justified. If reasonable officers could disagree, then there's official immunity. So we have discussion about the seriousness of the situation, about how the crowds were much heavier than usual because you have more distracted, intoxicated drivers in those heavy crowd situations, and because you have a high risk of disorderly and assaultive, vandalistic, and reckless conduct in those situations. You had Galvan testify about whether his immediate presence was necessary. He needed to help Silva control the crowd and prevent injuries to persons and property. He testified about what alternative courses were available, including trying the main lanes unsuccessfully because the traffic wouldn't move for him. And so he either had to use the shoulder lane, the bicycle lane, or leave Silva unassisted. And then the risk factors, testified that in the unlikely event a collision occurred, it would be a minor one because of his low speed. He testified that the likelihood of harm was minimal because he was traveling at a low speed, with lights and siren activated on a straight road, and motorists are expected to check the bicycle lane before entering or crossing it. And whether any risk was clear to a reasonably prudent officer was also addressed. He said he did not see Saucy's car until the moment of impact, and he was not expecting that car to pull ahead of him because left turning vehicles are supposed to check the bicycle lane and the intersections crosswalk for pedestrians before proceeding through.
Does it matter that the police report, Mr. Miller, finds fault with the police officer in trying to ascertain whether he was acting in good faith in performing his discretionary duties?
It does not find fault. The report did not give a citation to Galvan. It just makes a matter-of-fact statement that Galvan failed to yield the right-of-way. That doesn't mean that Galvan did not have a privilege to do so under the circumstances. Moreover, there's no finding of recklessness. So we have a report that's similar to the Accident Review Board's reprimand for failure to use due care in Harris County versus Spears, the 14th Court of Appeals case. Moreover, this court said in Torres that even an officer's subjective belief that he operated his vehicle without due regard does not prove recklessness. So we're talking about two different standards. Nothing in the investigating officer's report addresses the recklessness standard, so it is immaterial. In fact, the report is immaterial for another reason, and that is the investigating officer made a conclusion of law as to who had the right of way. I don't think the investigating officer properly considered, as the court must, that Saucy was making a left turn and under state law had to yield to oncoming traffic, bicycles in the bicycle lane, and pedestrians on the sidewalk while making that turn. So he had no right to just go through and make a left turn. He had to look and yield the right of way as he was making that turn.
Is there more of a duty on the police officer since he is doing something that he's, you know, going the bike lane? And I understand he's doing the bike lane, but that's not a road or a shoulder that a vehicle that put him at a more, what's the right word? Duty to ascertain, to make sure that there was no bikes or pedestrians, because that was a lane for bikes and pedestrians.
Well, if you look at Escobar and Spears, for example, the answer would be no, because both of those officers were driving 10 to 15 miles an hour, like Galvan, and they had partially obstructed views of traffic, and the court held the emergency response exception applicable there. If you look at Ross, the court found official immunity there, even though the officer was trying to, you know, weave perpendicularly across traffic to get to the accident scene. So, just if you look at the breadth of collision cases out there, you know, that doesn't get you there either under defeating official immunity or proving the recklessness. Let me also add something about this bicycle lane ordinance for the town of South Padre Island. You know, usually the cases look to the Transportation Code Chapter 546, which states four specific exceptions to generally applicable traffic laws, but then applies conditions to those exceptions. That's a law applicable to emergency action. A generally applicable traffic regulation like the town ordinance's bicycle lane provision is not. But even if we consider the bicycle lane provision, it says that the bicycle lane may be used in an emergency. So answering the question about an emergency answers the question about the bicycle lane provision.
Thank you. May it please the court. On July 4th, 2018, Mr. John Paul Saucy was heading home from work as he made a protect the left turn. As he cautiously made his turn, as he was clearing the lane, Officer Galvan, driving on a bike lane at around 20 miles per hour, failed to yield the right of way and hit Mr. Saucy. It's important to note that the island on July 4th is usually bumper to bumper traffic. And even Mr. Galvan has stated through his depositions that he was going at around 20 miles per hour. And 20 miles per hour might not seem a lot when it's regular traffic, but when you're on bumper to bumper traffic, 20 miles per hour on a bike lane is pretty fast. And that is one of the concerns that appellants had raised as to the recklessness. I think that goes directly to the recklessness of the officer driving over 20 miles when there's bumper to bumper traffic. Additionally, a lot of the evidence that was submitted through depositions, Officer Galvan failed to state that there was any emergencies. He claims that he had received a dispatch call. When we requested that through discovery, there is no dispatch log. So as Justice Benavidez argued, it's hard to prove a negative. When there's no dispatch logs, when there's no phone logs, well, how can we actually even go about proving that there was an emergency? If there had been any dispatch logs, I don't think we'd be having this hearing. I think Mr. Miller would have submitted that to the district court. Additionally, a lot of the cases that Mr. Miller cites, those are actual emergencies where you have the last two he cited, Department of Public Safety versus Escobar. That one, the officer saw the officer sees a vehicle run a red light. He turns on his emergency light and then starts chasing the other vehicle. I mean, I think that's pretty clearly an emergency situation. He's following somebody. But here, there is no emergency. And that is what we've always been claiming, that there hasn't been any emergency. There was no need for Officer Galvan to go the north side of the island. There is no record of any priority calls. And additionally, when his sergeant, who Officer Galvan claims called him, files a subsequent report, he doesn't make any note that he actually had called Officer Galvan to come aid him in the northern part of the island. Additionally, yes.
Based on the definition that Justice Benavidez read earlier, the conditions, I mean, we're all from the valley and we're all familiar with South Padre Island on the 4th of July. Don't the conditions that Mr. Miller described fit that definition?
Your Honor, I think it would if there wouldn't be any other officers on duty on South Padre during 4th of July. You know, for 4th of July, you have an overabundance of police officers, everybody from DPS, South Padre Island Police. And if there had been an emergency where officers were required, I know they are all on the same frequency. So dispatch would have put an emergency priority call. But when you have a communication which hasn't even been proved through an affidavit from one officer to another, where officer claims that he got a call, but his superior doesn't say that he called them, well, it calls into question if there really was an emergency. So I do agree with the law. I do agree with the definitions, but I think this is the case where the legislature specifically created this exception for things when, you know, an officer is just simply reckless and hits a common citizen. And I think that's what's
specifically- to say that we agree with you that there is a fact issue on the emergency situation. And I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Miller, which is, on official immunity, is your argument that the fact that he was going 20 miles per hour enough to overcome the burden for official immunity?
I think it would be one of the cumulative factors, Your Honor. I think it wouldn't be a one factor is a home run. I think if you look at it as a totality, if you look at the speed he was traveling, the depositions, then you look at the police officer's report, who does say that Officer Galvan is at fault. If you add all these in totality, well, I think it rises to the level of recklessness. In personal injury cases, usually a lot of times a police report is introduced to try to prove negligence. So, I mean, I think it kind of gives us an idea when you have an officer from South Padre Island, which is a different Police Department than the Cameron County Park Rangers, making a firsthand account or writing at the moment that this other person was at fault. So I think it would be a contributing factor, Judge.
Thank you.
Additionally,
now, let me ask you this question though. Mr. Miller says, and do you agree with him, that you carry the burden of proof? And even though we can have a discussion as to the inability to prove a negative, wasn't incumbent upon you to at least have some controverting evidence that the call did not occur, like Silva's deposition or some other type of policy that would have said, you know, as you just did, that if it was truly an emergency, it would have been logged in?
Yes, Judge. So that is correct. We do have the burden of establishing the burden of proof, but it's always difficult to prove a negative. And I guess that's why we have the discovery process. And through the discovery process, we actually tried to subpoena that phone, that cell phone from Officer Galvan. And the response was that the county or his superiors didn't have access to his personal phone. So I think the way the law is written is that we do have to prove, but it's difficult to prove something where we simply can't obtain any evidence. We've asked through discovery for the phone logs. We've asked through discovery for the actual phone. So it's very difficult for us to go about and say, well, there was no emergency. So we're going off what the depositions, that there's a conflict within the testimony. And we're also going on the police report, Judge. So I guess it's several factors put together that I think put us over the hump.
Okay.
There is a genuine issue of fact if there was an emergency. Additionally, the appellants also argue that an officer engaged in regular, I think as the court has noted, or the 14th report in Harris versus Gibbons, an officer engaged in regular driving absent special circumstances is not entitled to official immunity. And what we're saying here is that the record is also devoid of any evidence regarding the priority of the call or whether there was any concerns for the welfare of other motorists. And I think the cases that Mr. Miller cites, there usually is an affidavit or there's other evidence on behalf of the appellants that it would actually give them this indication that a reasonable prudent officer would have acted in the same way. And what we're saying here is that there is no evidence that would actually allow him to obtain official immunity, even if the court found that there was an emergency. Aside from that, judges, there really is no evidence to support that Officer Galvan's presence was necessary in another part of South Padre Island. And the court actually decided a case, Zapata versus City of Gonzales, that was decided on January 30th, 2020. So that's less than 2 years ago. And it's a very similar fact pattern. And in that case, the appellants or the city of, I guess it was the city of Gonzales or the district, Gonzales County, actually had moved for a plea to the jurisdiction. The district court actually granted the plea. And when it came up to the 13th court, it was overturned because there was a genuine issue of fact as to the emergency.
Who was that case again, Mr. De Leon? I'm sorry.
Zapata versus City of Gonzales, 13-18-00065. And that was, I believe, Justice Benavides was on that panel.
Was. Okay, thank you.
I don't know if there's any other questions.
Any additional questions, panelists?
No.
Trust me, they would ask if they had them. All right, thank you so much.
I yield my time, thank you.
Mr. Miller?
All right, let me burn through some things here. In the Zapata case, the officer was traveling 45 to 49 miles an hour through an intersection, and there was a dispute as to whether it was a red light or green light. So that is far different from what we have here. A lot of the stuff that was mentioned is not even in the record, the stuff about subpoenas and discovery responses. If the plaintiff wanted to rely on it, it should have been put in the record at the trial court level in the response to the plea of jurisdiction. It was not. I don't even know about it because I don't have it in this appellate record that I have. You know, a lot of this stuff is about what the plaintiff could have put in the record but didn't. You mentioned his deposition testimony, but you know, there's one page of Mr. Saucy's deposition in the record, and that's what we supply. There is no further testimony in this record from Mr. Saucy. There's no evidence dispatch would have put a priority or acted in a certain manner with respect to the call. But even then, there's nothing in the statute that requires an emergency call go through dispatch. And then how do you address the emergency situation part of the statute if you would require a call from dispatch? That's inconsistent with what the statute says. I want to get to the definition of emergency because I know the court used a dictionary definition in Torres, but you have to be careful with dictionary definitions. This is from the Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary 11th definition in the explanatory notes. The order of senses within an entry is historical. The sense known to have been first used in English is entered first. So you can't say that the legislature intended the first definition. We have to look at all the definitions. And if there's uncertainty about which definition the legislature intended, we have to go with the broadest definition to honor the rule that
are you telling me that as defined in Torres versus Sea of Corpus Christi, that definition is not correct?
It is just one definition of emergency. And in my dictionary, that's the definition that comes first. But that only means that, you know, the etymologists going through the records found that sense first, but that the other sense is also used.
Okay.
Yeah.
I still think we're stuck with this precedent in front of us at this point. I mean, I understand that when you pick up different definitions, you'll get different names, but I'm not sure that what you read is any more different than what's defined in Torres anyway. So.
Yeah. Well, I just raised that. I don't think that the court intended to exclude other definitions of emergency in Torres. So I think that you can look at the other definitions of emergency that come in a dictionary and determine what sense the legislature intended. The manner of the call shouldn't matter in determining whether it's an emergency call. The legislature didn't consider it important enough to say anything about it in the statute. And even when the Tort Claims Act was enacted, there were numerous ways to communicate with and between officers, including by phone, or by going up to an officer and telling him or her. So given the array of choices of how to communicate, courts shouldn't make policy choices for the agencies by saying it's not an emergency call if you use a personal cell phone. The statute doesn't limit the means of communication, so courts shouldn't either. And if you look at the Little case that we cite in our brief, the officer was using his cell phone to talk with his dispatcher. He was using his personal cell phone to talk with his dispatcher when the accident occurred. And again, emergency call is just one part of the equation because you also have to rule out an emergency situation. The Ross case that came out from Dallas last fall is important because it's one of several cases that says that an officer's own testimony can prove official immunity. Ross cites precedent for that. So Ross does not stand alone on that. You can have an officer testify, and if the plaintiff wants to challenge the officer's testimony on the official immunity factors, the plaintiff has the option of doing so by getting discovery and so forth. But again, we don't have any testimony from anybody else offered by the plaintiff in this. So that testimony can't be considered because it wasn't offered into the record. Let's see, there was a suggestion that Galvan said that he was traveling around 20 miles an hour. Galvan said 10 to 15 miles an hour. The eyewitness, Michael Wind, who's not affiliated with any of the parties, said in his statement, officer was clearly doing less than 20 miles per hour. That puts us into those cases like Escobar and Spears, given that speed and traveling through an intersection with the lights on and siren activated. It doesn't matter that his view was blocked. What matters is that he took action that showed that he cared about other motorists by going far below the 30 mile an hour speed limit.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Good arguments on both sides, and the case will be under submission.